Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Canis Albinus.
Makalua.
The Man Team.
Mega Bears Fan.
Welcome to 441st Polycast episode. My name is Imran Siddiqui, and I haven't been here in quite a while, and I have no idea what I'm doing. Joining me is Canis Albinus.
Oh boy, it's been a while.
Makula.
I've still been here this entire time. Sometimes I don't know what I'm doing either.
Mega Bears Fan.
No, I don't think any of us really knows what we're doing.
And the Mean Team.
Nevertheless, we can have a blast from the past together.
Oh.
So, Imran is a former Polycast regular co-host from the first three seasons, and famous for, at the time, not playing the game as much as the rest of the players, but still very important to the show's camaraderie.
I said that's what he said a lot.
Yes.
And occasionally forgetting to mute his mic, and we get to hear all sorts of details about what he was doing that day. Also, the toilet flushing.
Man, I thought you were going to never live down.
Jeez. I thought you were going to talk about the typing on a Pulton Civilization site while streaming or recording the episode.
Is that too? I mean, but hey, people still know me for whipping the Sistine Chapel, so, you know.
I would never be caught posting on site storing.
Except when he does.
Every time.
No, I didn't say I wouldn't do it. I said I wouldn't. It's not true, though. I would be caught.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I've even been on a Civilization message board. Politan, been a long time. Civ Fanatics, been a long time. I've mostly been on Reddit these days, and that's how I get my Civ 7 news.
Speaking of Civ 7 news, we've got a lot of it this week. But first, we're going to start with something else. We've got a new challenge of the month for Civ 6. And this one is Know Your Enemy. In this game, you play as... Oh, what's her name?
Wu Zetan.
And she is on a team with Yongle and Qin Shi Huang, who are trying to hold back waves of attacks from Genghis Khan. And the idea is, because Wu Zetan's ability has to do with spycraft, you should use espionage to successfully defeat the Mongols. Now, I have not played this one yet, because I have been busy preparing to move. But so far, there isn't a lot of chatting about it in the thread on Civ Fanatics, which we will link in the show notes. Apparently there's a possibility that Mongolia won't even attack you if you're playing on the prince level. So,
oops.
I mean, if you're building a lot of military units, I could see why the AI wouldn't want to attack you, but...
Yeah, go put an end to the barbarians for good.
So this is, it is available in Prince or Emperor. The map type is custom, and the map size is custom. Resources are sparse, the world is old, temperature is standard, and sea level is low.
So my question is, what is the actual victory condition then? Like, do you actually have to defeat Genghis, or you just have to survive for a length of time, in which case him not attacking you just automatically wins the game for you?
I'm not sure. It doesn't say. I imagine it has to do with just regular victory.
Yeah, because I'm not seeing an alternate victory condition in here, so I'm guessing that must mean it's just a regular victory condition. So, don't know if Mongolia not attacking you makes that harder or easier.
I would imagine if Mongolia isn't attacking you, it won't be that hard, since you're on a team with the other three, with the other two AIs.
Not that apparently it's going to stop them from aggressively settling towards you, apparently. Like, we're on a team, guys.
Well, the AI doesn't understand how things work.
Yeah, I'd imagine if you don't even have to defend yourself in war, like defensively, that the AI doesn't think it can beat you, that it, you can probably come up with a way to win the game. If not by just killing Mongolia, then you can take your pick, basically.
Yeah, and there's at least one poster in here who was on Emperor and had the same experience where they just didn't attack.
Yeah, in which case, the biggest challenge of the game, I think, becomes putting up with the AI allies' city placements.
Just don't look too much.
I'm gonna rage quit because you didn't put that city on the river. Come on!
I mean, this is a bold move to give players a window into the AI's quote-unquote capabilities. I mean, it's hard to make an effective AI, but like looking at its behavior under the hood is questionable.
Yeah, because I'm assuming that if you're on like an actual team, you get visibility to all their units and cities and see everything they're doing.
Yeah,
right?
Probably.
Like this is actual team play, not just like they're your allies or whatever.
Yeah, I don't know if it like lets you see everything. I've never actually tried it in Civ 6.
You know, neither have I. So I have no idea what that looks like.
Well, like even if you just had full visibility of everything they're doing, like even if you couldn't see the production bars or whatever, if you're paying attention, it would be pretty obvious like what they're building when and like what kinds of district placements and all that they're doing in the moment, how they're moving their units, etc. It would still be obvious. And it's kind of like when you make an alliance in a Paradox game and then go fight the AI like somebody else, you get to see what your allied AI is doing. And it's usually not good things.
Oh, dear.
I mean, they just move so suboptimally. But like, you know, and if you're fighting AI, then so does the other target. So it's not like they can't be used, but you kind of are hurting cats. And I'm sure Civ will be very similar.
So this challenge is available until... Oh, dang it, I closed it because I'm an idiot.
Correct.
October 16th.
October 16th. So go ahead and try it, and I will play it at some point when I have time, and I will report back on the next episode, most likely.
Yeah, I totally didn't even see that this was a thing because I've been neck deep in Civ 7 news. And I'm guessing that's probably a reason why there's not a lot of activity about this on the forums, is everybody's paying attention to Civ 7 stuff.
Yeah, there's only, what, 3 or 4 posts in this thread? 8, okay. And now it's time for Civ 7.
Yay. Which means it's time for more live streams and more live streams. Do you like live streams? We hope you like live streams, because you're going to get a lot of live streams in the next few months. But they did go online a few days, on the 12th, which is over a week ago when we were recording. But there was did a live stream talking about in more detail about the Antiquity Age. Me scrolling, trying to figure out, where's my spot? No, Brain doesn't know where spot is, but I did watch it live. It's been a week. I'm trying to remember things from a week ago.
It's impossible.
Yeah, this thing is 2 hours long as well, so.
Yeah.
There was a lot. I'm sorry. I'm blanking.
Okay, let's talk about...
And it wasn't
about...
just Antiquity, though, too.
Yeah, they
jumped into exploration for a bit.
Yeah. They showed us the way that the transition happens between eras. And that was pretty interesting. It talks about how when you transition between one era to the next era, or the next age, it brings up all of your points from the... I gotta look at Well of Souls to remember what the actual name of this is. The Legacy Paths. And you talk about you throughout the age, you are building up things like if you're doing the science one, you're trying to get all of the codexes. And if you're trying to do the culture ones, I don't remember exactly what the culture one was, but for military, it's like you have to own a certain number of cities. And as you're doing this, you get points. And with each point, you get to unlock a feature or a extra power in the next era. And then they talked about pantheons, which we have a full list of pantheons now, or not a full list, but at least a large list. We've got city patron goddess and all of that lovely stuff, happiness from mountains and natural wonders and such. There's a whole list here. Do we want to go through that list?
I don't think that's necessary.
It's all on Well of Souls if you need to look it up, but there's all basically the same kind of stuff that there was in Civ 4 and Civ 5. Stone circles and sacred waters, god of the sea, god of the sun, god of the forge, god of the forest. All with their own things. And these are all for Exploration era.
Exploration or Antiquity? Rising.
Or Antiquity, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, it would be it'd be interesting if they chose to move all that into Exploration. But...
Oh, right, the pantheons are in
Yeah.
Antiquity. I'm sorry.
I was just thinking of like Spain picking stone circles, and, you know, like the age of exploration when their ship should be trying to find the Americas.
Well, I think they mentioned at some point that religion would be really different in exploration. So the Pantheon stay throughout the entire antiquity age. And then exploration is more, I guess you pick your religion and then you try to spread it. So it's a weird system. I guess, I mean, the entire ages thing is almost like you're playing three games, right? And then you have the little crisis thing at the end of each age to bunch everyone back up before you go into the next age.
Yeah, I wonder to what extent that's going to be true. I'll cover that a little bit more in a moment.
We learned that you can build any tile improvements whenever you want, but in order to get the yields, you have to unlock the techs. So the techs don't unlock the improvements, they unlock the yields.
Huh.
So we'll be able to put down pastures or farms, but they will be more productive once we unlock the techs.
Right.
I mean, you still have to pay some kind of resource to make the improvements, though. So I don't know what the benefit to that would be.
Well, they're all like districts now, right? So they're built by the cities, presumably using production. Yeah.
Well, sure, but that still is an opportunity cost to the extent that it's going to be questionable to pre-build many improvements. Like there'll be like sometimes where you can get a little bit more total yield by having it available immediately on hitting it. But I would imagine that for the most part, you should be building things that actually confer a benefit that you don't have to wait for.
Yeah, but I'm also assuming that they're segregated by the age. So presumably you're not building like offshore oil platforms in antiquity either. So the improvements that you would be pre-building are things that you're probably going to get yield from relatively soon.
Even if they let you do that, doing that would be a flex. It's like, I am so far ahead that I'm going to build this improvement that's not going to do anything for 80 turns.
Well, you
just
have to
show off.
You have to unlock the... I presume that the strategic resources are unlocked by techs.
It looks like they're by age.
Oh,
yeah, because as the map expands, then it's going to... That's what they were talking about in a previous live stream about the thing with the ages is the map will expand a bit and you'll have new continents, you'll have new resources and stuff for you to go get. You may not necessarily have that resource back home.
Do we discover new like bonus and luxury resources as the maps expand or the ages pass as well, or is it just strategic resources?
I think it was implied to be both, because I think partly like in exploration they're imitating that whole spice trade thing. This is why the exploration started, because they were looking for new spices. They wanted to get around the Silk Road and stuff.
Yeah, that was the impression that I got, but I wasn't sure if they meant that there would be like legitimately like new resources would appear on the map, or if it just meant like there's more pressure or reward for getting more copies of the resources that already exist or something like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You might have a few of the things scattered on the original, your home continent, but then you might have a bigger concentration elsewhere. And if you're doing a lot of trading, you have the incentive to go look for it.
Yeah. Or even just like those resources always existed on the map. It's just now your population like wants like all of the resources instead of just like the three or four that appeared near, you know, where you started. So you got to go out and find them all and get them all and, you know, kill whoever already have them.
Your population heard about this really cool material called silk and now they want it.
Right. But the question is the silk like actually new resource that wasn't there before, or was it always there, but just, you know, someone else had it?
I don't think I've seen enough gameplay to know yet.
I don't think we have.
That's,
I would hope that some new resources are within nation's borders and others aren't, just normally when an age flips, like they generate new resources. A lot of them are in the new map area, but you still get new resources in the existing map area as well, I would hope.
Yeah, but
it makes the most sense to me.
But I really do hope that there are legitimately new resources, because that's something, you know, it's especially like bonus and luxury resources. We've always had strategic resources, you know, being unlocked and revealed as the game goes on, but not so much with the bonus and luxury resources. And that is really interesting, because that actually does create almost like a second stage of exploration, right? Especially if there's a mechanic, and I don't know if they'd go this far, but if you actually have to send scouts or units back out to find those resources, like, do they just appear on the map and you know exactly where they all are, or do you literally have to send units out to go find where these new new resources are, because they weren't on the map before.
Well, I would hope that stuff, I don't know. I think it'd be annoying if you had to like retrace Fog of War and you didn't have any indicator for that. Like Fog of War, that's the real Fog of War, and Fog of War, that's like, okay, now that the map has been updated, this isn't real Fog of War anymore. Like, I think that'd be annoying. On the other hand, because the map itself is expanding, there will still be a legitimate exploration aspect, even if you don't like force re-exploration of the fog.
Yeah, that's true too. But we've also seen stuff where like the scouts have like really far, you know, fields of vision. You can set up those like outpost towers and stuff like that, that like give you like crazy range. So you can uncover that fairly quickly. So, you know, I could imagine maybe something happening where you just like, you park your scout in like the middle, you know, of a, you know, large swath of open land, tell him to build one of those little outpost things and reveal whatever happens to be in that area, or maybe even be able to reveal that there might be resources like just outside of his field of vision, if that makes sense. So stuff like that, where there are, you know, convenience features, but like where you actually do have to go and explore again.
And the other thing that we don't really know right now is how feasible slash optimal it'll be to fill the map in mostly that's explored, just because we don't know how many like your city cap. We don't know what that's going to look like relative to number of players and map size yet, for sure. And that's something they could even change before the release date still. But it might be the case where you really do see most of the known world by the time the next age comes along. And so you're sending those scouts into non-fog anyway, for the most part, because your cities will see the majority of the map, or it'll be in the AI's territory.
Elevator music? What's going on?
Just briefly.
When you accidentally put your elbow on the wrong controller.
Uh-oh.
Whee!
No volume down!
Yeah, but it would be interesting to see, because, you know, historically, right, luxury resources is one of the reasons you went to explore other places.
And
it would be interesting to see when the map expands, how much is empty and how much is full.
And that's always, in my opinion, been something that's been kind of like underutilized or underemphasized in the Civilization games in the past, because there's never really been a huge amount of pressure, you know, in the mid game to go out and acquire new resources beyond what you already have, right? Like, as long as you're not just building a crap ton of new cities and need the extra happiness and stuff like that, like, you're often in an equilibrium, right, by that point in the game, where there is very little pressure to expand other than to defeat hostile, you know, neighbors.
Yeah.
So if they really do have a system where, like, you go into a new age and it is like there is a whole new map to explore, like, that could be really, really cool, because the early game exploration has always been my favorite part of a Civilization game. And now if that basically happens three times every game, like, that has a pretty good chance of potentially keeping me a lot more engaged and interested in the middle and late game. So it'll be interesting to see how that actually does play out.
Did they say that the map expands again in modern time? Yes. I know it does in exploration. Oh, it does again? Okay.
I think it does every age.
But a map expansion in the modern era could also mean, like, different things, right? Maybe it's not necessarily expanding horizontally, but maybe it's expanding, you know, vertically. Like, you know, being able to cross mountains and, you know, go, you know, you could build submarines and stuff like that. Maybe there's stuff on the ocean floor that you can explore. Who knows? Like, it could be something like that, too.
Are they hiding a space layer from us?
Yeah, I mean, we could even have something like that. I mean, we've seen that before in Beyond Earth. So there could be something like that, too, where you're, like, literally exploring the, you know, orbit, or, you know, exploring stuff in space. Who knows?
Alpha Centauri.
Or maybe that's expansion material. You get to explore the moon.
You unlock a second map, which is a different planet. Yeah, that would be interesting.
I think I've played that game before.
Well, we've never seen them packed into one game together, and I think that would be a bit of a nightmare. But
we've always joked about it, right? We've always joked about you win the space race victory in Civ 5, and it just like automatically boots up Beyond Earth.
Yeah.
Now you can have both.
But it could be something different for the space race type of a victory if you have to send satellites to other planets first, because that's how in real life we started. We went to the moon, then we started sending things to all the other planets, and it's, you know, progressive. So maybe there's a little more of a detail. I hope there's a little more of a detailed path of the space race. But they haven't told us about the modern era yet.
So we get narrative events this time. And these are based on who your leader is, not what your civ is, apparently. And it's usually like it's very similar to the quest system from Beyond Earth, actually. It gives you one or two options, or three options, I think. The first option is culture, the second appears to be production, and the third is money. At least, that's the screenshot we saw from the Augustus game that they were doing in the live stream. So we had, the Senate is in session and voices are raised in conflict. This is for Augustus. You have the option to listen to the senator who's complaining, and it gives you the quest to build three monuments. Or you can only the strength of the army and strength and loyalty of the army matters, which gives you which says you need a commander with three promotions. And then the third option is there's greater pleasures in life than politics, which just gives you a cash bonus. And these are tied to their leaders, I believe.
I do really like the idea in principle of like your population or your cities like asking you to do things for them. And giving more of a feeling of like there are actually people living there who like want things and not just, you know, just being nothing but the state. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And I think, what is it? Is the reward for doing one of these quests, I guess, a point for that age or whatever on the victory conditions? Is that what you get if you do it?
I'm not sure. I don't think it's actually been told exactly.
Yeah, I don't know that we have granular information on how like the game is won in totality.
Right.
And, like how impactful each thing will be.
I mean, I think at this point, the best guess would be they've already told us that at the end of, at the very least, the Antiquity Age, there's some kind of crisis, you know, that's kind of like a boss fight, you know, so to speak, I guess. But so but presumably
the game there.
Yeah, but presumably every age probably has something like that. So maybe, yeah, you win the game by resolving the modern era crisis. Or maybe we just have the classic victory conditions. You build the spaceship, you know, sell everyone your blue jeans and do all that stuff.
Yeah, or if you do the classic thing, it makes a lot of the previous age outcomes less relevant.
Right, which is why I think that there's probably going to be a greater emphasis on, like I said, the modern era having some kind of crisis thing similar to what they've already talked about in the Antiquity Age. There basically being a boss fight at the end of the game that you have to win.
Well, now, there's a problem too, though, because let's say that one nation wins, like, the majority of the ages, aside from modern age. Is the modern age crisis winner still the winner of the game? Because if that's true, then once again, most of the game doesn't matter. Only the modern age matters, if that's what happens. So, like, I don't think you can make the outcome of a single age determinative of victory without trivializing the remaining ages.
Yeah, but with only three ages, you can't just, like, count up who won the number of ages, because if you have, you know, if you're in an eight-player game, you know, which has traditionally been a standard-size map, and one different civ wins each of the eras, then like you just have a three-way tie and say, okay, well, all three of you won.
I mean, presumably you can have like a score that is used to make the ranking in the first place, and like, you know, you could get like 3 seconds or something and wind up with the highest score.
Yeah. Well, it looks like in the age progress screenshot that we got, you know, you have kind of these legacy path things and it ends in a golden age. Now that's just the screen we got. I don't know if there's a score somewhere else. But there's a legacy path, and I guess there's another victory condition on the top of that age progress. And I wonder if you add those up, or if the, you know, if you get a golden age in every one, like that puts you in kind of a better position for the next age. So maybe that's the way, if you win an age, you get a golden age, a better, or you can get multiple different golden ages, right? You can get a military style golden age, you can get an economic golden age. So maybe you can get four different things in a golden age, which will really help you in that age. And maybe that will kind of allow for a cascading sort of thing without having to be like, all right, let's count up who won each thing.
Yeah, there's also a balancing act for that too, though, because you have to be careful to balance the game such that whoever wins the Antiquity Age doesn't just snowball, you know, through the other two ages and you know, is too powerful, you know what I'm saying? And then there's no point in playing the other two ages, right? And then we run back to an even worse case of the old problem of the late game, you know, isn't very fun to play because you're just hitting end turn until the victory screen. Like, now you've had the game explicitly tell you, well, you've won the first age and you have an overwhelming advantage going into the later two. So, you know.
Yeah, no, I mean, and that's the whole, I'm not going to say issue, but the whole concern with ages, right? Like, you know, this is a lot to get right, you know?
Yeah, and this is, as far as I know, it's a totally new thing. Like, I'm not aware of any other, you know, grand strategy game that does this, because we've seen a lot of things in Civ 7 that look similar to things that humankind did, right? With the switching civilizations each era, you know, some of the unit stacking things, some of the district things look a lot like humankind, but humankind still does not break its game up where you like win an era, right? It just has one running cumulative victory point score, so there's no analog there to be like, okay, well, are they going to do this better or worse than humankind did?
This might be a good time to transition to our next topic, which is the Developer Diary on Ages from Ed Beach. So now that we're getting into this, I think I'll bring up that this is one of our topics, and their express design purpose for Ages is listed in the dev diary. Now, like the top three bullet points they list, although they have more reasons, are against snowballing, against too much micromanagement, and balancing civs. I certainly agree with the third, that is much easier to balance when you actually have proper ages for the civs that existed later in history.
Yeah, you don't
so
have
that,
to
that's make... a that's a pretty clear, like, that's good.
Yeah, you don't
I have
to make
concerns
a version
with
Sumeria, you know, that is balanced for the modern era.
Yeah, I have concerns with snowballing. Like, there's two ways this can go, because the main problem in Civ is that the game is functionally over before it's over. So how much is this going to be? You're playing three separate games in one game, which could be interesting and fun, versus this is a rubber band mechanic, which I think could easily ruin the game if they use it as a rubber band mechanic. So, because again, if you make ages into a rubber band, then it means that performing well in the early ages doesn't matter that much. It's the exact opposite problem of what we've had in Civ to date. So right. I hope they don't take it to that extreme. But I do think that there's some interesting, like if you make it three distinct games and the winner is the person who does the best in all three, that's not necessarily bad. And they're right that they, like, more than half of the players don't finish their games. That's probably indicative of a design issue. I have some major reservations that in this talk about that as an issue, that we're not mentioning the user interface whatsoever. I think that's a red flag in my mind. I know this is about ages, so that you're going to be emphasizing your discussion of ages, but the lots of micromanagement issue, the games take long in the end game, it's not exciting. Like, a lot of that is a manufactured problem by Firaxis of having a poor UI, period, in the late game.
A lot of it also, though, has to do with the way that the kind of scope of the game changes. And I'm talking about older Civilization games, not Civilization 7 here, right? Because in the late game, you still have all of the exact same mechanics that you were playing with at the beginning of the game when you just have one, two, three cities and a handful of units. So if by basically restarting the game and changing even the mechanics so that some of the mechanics work differently in each age, like, I would hope that the reason they're doing that is to solve the very problem you're talking about. So you're going to have mechanics and UI and stuff like that that are geared towards managing a larger empire in the exploration and modern ages, and not having to do all of the micro scale management that works very well in the early game when you only have a small amount of stuff to worry about, but then becomes tedious in the late game when all of that stuff is now multiplied by a factor of 10.
I hope you're right. I'll believe it when I see it. It's been more than a decade of bad UI. I do not have faith in this particular aspect of the game because it's been bad for so long. And you know, you could use a good user interface that scales up well. It's still a good interface before it has to scale up well. So, like, if there's a good implementation of, like, optimizing your inputs, there's no reason that shouldn't exist in antiquity, even if it'll be more useful in modern.
Yeah, sure. I mean, again, like, unless
there's necessarily still going to be more stuff in the late game, because the map is going to be larger. There's going to be more cities on the map, presumably, because there's going to be more cities. There's going to be more units and places to put the units and micromanagement to do. In order for this to not bog down to at least some extent, regardless of the Aegis system, you still need to have a good user interface. Well, and I hope they pull it off this time. I do, but I don't have much faith, because it's two games in a row now, or it's been questionable. Although, actually, admittedly, six is better than five.
Going back again, I talked a little while ago about how there are a lot of things in Civ 7 that remind me of Humankind. I don't know, Iman, did you play Humankind, by the way? I think Canis and Mackie and me and team haven't, but I don't know if you did.
I have not, no. I didn't even know it really existed that much. Like, I think I heard about it, and then, like, all of a sudden people were saying, Civ 7's like Humankind. I'm like, oh yeah, I think I remember hearing about that. And then I realized, oh, they had a Civ change thing. So that's how much I didn't really know about Humankind.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. So anyway, going on to what Phil was just talking about, so something that could also happen is maybe the number of cities doesn't necessarily increase later in the game, because maybe cities that are close together maybe collapse into one city that now you only have to manage as a single city. And Humankind actually did have something similar, where you could merge multiple nearby cities together into, I forget what they called it, they had a name for it, like province or something like that, where you would, I think, then manage those cities more as like one unit. Yeah. So they could be doing something similar here too, where you have 12 cities in, you know, say the exploration age, right? But then you go into the modern age, and now, you know, you have maybe now that's basically collapsed down from 12 bespoke cities to, like, you know, four, you know, metropolitan area kind of things. If that, does that make sense?
Yeah, I just like to point out that you could do things like this in Civ 4 if you wanted.
Well, I will say, could, and yeah. Also, Civ 6 introduced, like, you know, or had a governor mechanic that you could build up to be more robust in a way to reduce micromanagement. But then, of course, then you might run into the issue that you have to micromanage the governors. But there are ways that you can reduce micromanagement. Of course, everything is all speculation, because, you know, they're very tight-lipped about what the modern age even looks like at this point.
If you're micromanaging one governor in the place of having to micromanage, say, the four cities that one governor is managing, then that's still, you know, on paper, less micromanagement than you had before.
Right.
Assuming it's usable. Which,
yes,
I'll see.
I mean, these are a lot of hypotheticals going on here, right?
Well, I mean, like, there's two layers to that. Like, does the ability exist at all? And then, is it good enough that you'd use it in lieu of just giving orders direct?
Yeah,
I'm still. Civ 4 had a governor, and that was pretty bad. Whereas the user interface aspect, where you could select three or four cities and change stuff about them simultaneously for all four, that was extremely useful.
Right, like being able to control click and shift click on a build queue to just add everything, or just add the same thing to like every city's build queue, because, you know, it's something you just unlocked and something that you want in every city.
Yeah, or you could like actually change the tiles that are all working to a degree. Now it's like really micromanagement that you'd have to. You have to go into each city. But if you just wanted to switch them between like production or commerce or food focus, and you understood like how the game assigns citizens to tiles for that, you actually could update multiple cities at a time to the like degree of tile swapping shift selecting.
If I remember correctly from some of the earlier stuff we've seen, like it looks like we don't even have like populations working specific tiles anymore. So
yeah.
All of that.
I'm just using that as an example. Like, you could get to that level of micromanagement in like a tiny fraction of the clicks that that would be necessary by default. Like, if you wanted to do the same thing in Civ 6, like change tiles worked in three cities or four cities, let's say four cities simultaneously, we're talking the difference between like less than 10 inputs and probably over 50. Like, it's not a small difference. And that just scales up. The more stuff that happens on the map, the more types of mechanics like this you have. Like, now we're comparing like 20, less than 20 inputs to like hundreds of inputs per turn. It just goes nuts. And the later games too have issues with input buffering. So like, even if you could in principle select all this stuff like super fast, like faster than a human could do it even, the game won't let you, because it can't process that. Even if you turn animations off, It simply can't acknowledge that you're moving units as fast as a human can move units, let alone moving faster than that. So you get gated by the game's ability to update your orders.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely understand all of these concerns, you know, but...
Like, I don't want to say they won't do it. Like, maybe it'll be awesome. And they've clearly shown some care for this because of how they've introduced moving units with a commander.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
like, it might be really good. I don't want to be too negative before I actually experience it, because they've at least shown signs that this is on the radar to some degree.
Well, the commander, not only on the radar, but it sounds like, from what you just read from Ed Beach, it sounds like that's a major design goal.
Well, they're going for a design goal that I agree with maybe a different solution than I think is the solution. That being said, like, just because it's a different solution than I do, like, the what they're using still might be good. It might not solve the problem.
Yeah,
unless they're also doing the user interface aspect.
Yeah, I'm not a game designer, so if an actual game designer comes up with a solution to a game design problem, he probably has a better idea than I do.
I mean, you never know. It's so hit or miss. Yeah, even for people who've done it a long time, they try things that don't work, and then they try things that do work.
Yeah.
And the sage among them are aware that they both are a possibility.
Well, I mean, and like we said, we haven't seen modern era. They could have rapidly, you know, or completely redone a lot of it to make it less micromanaging, right? Because that's...
Yeah.
Governors, the commanders might be able to hold 10 units or something like that, right? You know,
we know for a fact that expands. Yeah. Like, yeah. Commanders can hold more.
Yeah, that was also the case in Humankind. Like, I think as you research new technologies, it would increase the cap of how many units you could put into an army. So I'm assuming they're going to have a similar thing here, although it might be locked behind ages instead of behind bespoke technology, but same principle.
So yeah, it's probably going to be better than Civ 6 just by changing the mechanics. There's going to be fewer inputs, but I would also like to see the UI improved in addition to that. We'll see, though. Maybe it will be.
Yeah, the other thing is they talked about some age transitions for civs, and I've been thinking about this for a while. I think they kind of shot themselves in the foot with the first reveal by doing the Hatshepsut going Egypt to Songhai, which everyone freaked out about. And I was thinking, like, if they just did Rome, Norman, French, even though, I mean, that's kind of, I mean, people would probably be more accepting, but everyone was like, Egypt to Songhai makes absolutely no sense. And then in this age transition, they go, actually, it's Abbasid is really their exploration age.
Well,
yeah.
It made sense because they were talking about it as a gameplay. You know, the two were linked by gameplay because they both had abilities and stuff that revolved around navigable rivers. Right. And they were trying to highlight navigable rivers as a new feature. So, I get what they were trying to do there, but I do think you're right. Like, the thing people saw more of was the civilization transition and not so much the game mechanic.
Right.
Transition. Yeah, they probably could have emphasized more that the Songhai or something you unlock.
Right, because of the fact that you're on a bunch of rivers or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, you could figure that out, but yeah, they could have made that more clear where that, you know, that Egypt has a different auto transition that's available. However, because these were similar, you can also do this.
Right. Yeah. And I remember in that first reveal, they explicitly said that, like, oh, we're showing you this transition because of the gameplay similarities between these two factions. And I think they talked about how every civ is going to have like one historic civilization that they transition to, and then one ability or gameplay one, and then you could unlock other ones by how you specifically play. Like, the example that kept coming up is if you improve a bunch of horse resources, you unlock the Mongolians or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, this is way more on the readers than on their release information. But it is also true that people don't read. Some people read, but a lot of people don't read.
Right, doing Rome to the Holy Roman Empire to, you know, modern day Britain or something like that probably would have been a much more easier pill for people to swallow.
But it doesn't, then it doesn't really showcase the ability to split into something that's completely unrelated to the first age civ because you unlock it.
True.
Which they also want to advertise.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, they could have structured it in a way that fewer people had the misconception, but ultimately it's still on the reader because they did say how it works. And
well, yeah, but not everyone watches videos, right? They look, they get, you know, because they don't want like, you know, 5 million YouTube ads. So they go, oh, okay, someone shared a picture, right? And they're like, wait a second. So I think that was one of the issues. And you know, they didn't make sure or clear that, oh, hey, you know, what is Egypt's actual, you know,
well, I mean, if people are just looking at screenshots or like snippets or whatever and making assumptions, that's not on Firaxis.
Yeah, but welcome to the, you know, modern internet age.
Yeah,
the social media. Yeah, but like, I don't think Firaxis needs to cater to that. That those people can figure it out on their own. It's fine.
But they could also have, you know, killed two birds with one stone and just, you know, made a big point of being like, oh, well, Egypt is transitioning to the Songhai because, you know, they have a lot of abilities on navigable rivers. But in the meantime, the other player over here is Rome, and they're becoming the Normans because that's a historic, you know, transition. Like, they could have emphasized that both of these things are happening simultaneously in the same game. Right. So people would be like, oh, well, there are options. And there also are more historical, you know, themed transitions as well.
I don't know, man. We had a written chart and everything. I don't know if that came from Firaxis, but there's plenty of information. I think in this regard, we don't like it. It would have been nice if they did it perfectly, but they did it more than well enough. I don't think we need to hold hands more than.
I agree. I think people are overreacting. But we also had the same problem with Humankind, too. Right. And Humankind like makes no attempt to link the new civilization that you choose in each age. Like, you just pick it, it's a first come first serve. You pick whoever is available. And there, and you know, very quickly players found out that there was a meta where certain they call them cultures in Humankind, not civilization, but certain cultures are like better than others. And whoever is the first into a new era should always pick, you know, this culture. Right. So it's a race to get a specific culture as opposed to just, or, you know, trend getting whatever is best for your particular play style or your gameplay situation.
Yeah.
And it looks like, you know, Civ
that
7
might still be true in Civ 7. Well, like, that'll come down to how they balance the civs.
Because, well, but like, not
people
necessarily
will go for the unlockables. If there's an unlockable that's good enough, it will draw people to concentrate on that.
I mean,
but I'm sure they're going to try to avoid that both through availability and to not make overpowered civilizations. Like, and that's hard to avoid in its entirety, but I'm sure they'll balance, or they'll try to balance. They'll make balance changes so that if it looks like everyone is trying to improve Three Horses and they're making otherwise suboptimal decisions just to unlock Mongolia, maybe they'll give a look at Mongolia then and like change it. Because that would be kind of absurd.
And I think Civ 7 has a more uphill battle in that regard compared to Humankind, because in Humankind it was a new culture for every era transition, and the eras in Humankind were more analogous to the eras in like Civilization 6. There were like 7 of them, right? So you're changing cultures 7 times throughout the game. So the period of time and the amount of gameplay that you spend with any given culture is considerably shrunk. So you would think it would be even easier in that case to balance them. Whereas in Civ 7, you know, like the antiquity age basically looks like it's covering the ancient and classical and maybe part of the, you know, medieval era. So it's a longer breadth of gameplay that these different civs have to remain balanced with each other for.
Yeah. I mean, it's a task that they'll have to see if they can balance. I mean, obviously in any civ there are eventually, right, you find out that there's some that are really good at, you know, at certain things, and you hopefully we don't have that here. And, you know, hopefully some of them are locked away. I mean, I don't know, like, you know, as you mentioned or mentioned before, Mongolia gets three horses. I mean, I wonder if it's for anyone Mongolia gets three horses, or it's specific civs that are around that general area that could get Mongolia if they get three horses.
So yeah, that's, like, could the Aztecs become the Mongolians by building three horses?
Right. I mean, because Mongolia at some point was in Egypt, historically, right? So who knows?
Yeah, not for long, but they are.
Right.
Yeah, like anyone in North Africa, Asia, Europe, like that makes like historic kind of thematic sense. But yeah, if you're talking about like, you know, you've got like a Native American tribe or the Aztecs or someone like that, it becomes a little bit harder to justify, because the Mongolians, as wide as their empire was, they weren't crossing the strait into Alaska.
And, I do not agree, because this is not Earth. Like, so, like, we don't know what the North American tribes would have become in a different scenario with different resources and different nations they're interacting with. I don't think it's correct to say that if you take Aztec and you put them in Central Asia and let history take its course while they're surrounded by like China and like let's say randomly France is in Eastern Europe instead of, you know, the historical Eastern European nations. We don't know what that looks like. I don't think you make assumptions about what that looks like. I think it would be pretty reasonable for them to gain some capability of working with horses in that scenario. And the North American natives certainly made good uses of horse once they were reintroduced. Like, they adapted to that pretty quickly. So I don't know that we can say that they wouldn't be able to make that kind of transition, even though couldn't historically. But historically, they have different limitations than that the map will present in Civ 7.
I think the idea was more just to say, like, there might be restrictions, that prevent or limit the selection of...
Yeah.
Right, and that was just one example, right? Like, I'm not saying that that's the way I want the game to work, just trying to come up with a hypothetical.
Yeah, I think you might be right that they might, like, limit the number of civs you can transition to based on your starting civ, but I hope not. I hope it's based on the map, because that will make the game more dynamic and make what's on the map more important.
Like,
but you're right, like, we'll see.
If you're on a continent that literally just doesn't have any horse resources on it,
then you're not Mongolia.
Like, clearly, you're not going to become Mongolia unless you also happen to like roll a civilization that has one of the automatic, abilities to transition to Mongolia.
And then you might not even want to.
And then you probably wouldn't want to because you don't have any horses. Or maybe you do, just to deny it to another player. I don't know. Maybe they're that good.
Well, let's hope that's the kind of thing where they need to be balanced. Like, if they're so good that you'll pick them to deny them to other people, then they should probably be tweaked.
And that was a problem in humankind, right? Where where there was, broad agreement that certain cultures were so much better than other cultures that, like, if you got into the new era, and even if this wasn't the best culture for you, you should probably still pick them to deny it to someone who's going to be able to make better use of them.
I don't think you can ever perfectly balance those, but I think you can balance them well enough to block that kind of stuff.
Yeah, some of them in humankind were pretty bad.
Yeah. I mean, it's not to be that way, though. That's a failing on balance in humankind. It doesn't have to be like that in Civ.
Yeah, and I think they, to their credit, I think, like, patches over, like, the year or so after the game came out, I think alleviated some of that stuff, but, it's been a while since I've played that game, so I don't remember for sure.
Yeah. Okay, so some other things for Ages that's confirmed in this dev diary. We've been touching on things here and there throughout, but we have some bullet point stuff, like, this is where I saw the confirmation that, yes, each age unlocks resources. Here it doesn't specify strategic or luxury, hopefully both, but it doesn't say either way in this case. Yeah, I mean, obviously new civics and technologies are unlocked. Same with buildings and wonders. Game systems will change between ages. That's confirmed here. Same with the playable map. We will probably see modern exclusive mechanics to play around per our earlier discussion.
But is that just something as simple as like, oh, there is religion right in antiquity, or there's pantheons in antiquity and religions in exploration, and then religion peters off in the modern era, which is
that might not be a simple, like you say, simple as, but like if we have pantheons that transition into like holy wars, which then taper off. That's not a small thing.
Well, but what I'm getting at is like Civ 6 kind of already did that, though, right? Like, that's not something that you need the ages to accomplish.
Well, but it also depends how strongly they're doing it and how much like it becomes a central part of playing through a particular age.
Right.
Leaders remain same across age. Traditions always available. Some buildings are ageless. Oh, and commanders persist. So like the experience and whatnot you're getting on the commanders will pay off long term. That's confirmed in the dev diary. Anyway, it's an estimated 13-minute, 16-second read that's interestingly precise at the top of it. So if you guys want to check out the full, and by you guys, I mean our listeners, want to check out the full list of rationale from Ed Beach, you can look at it.
I guess some of the stuff that's really interesting is in terms of... they talk about traditions as well, based on the specific civic tree. So those things create kind of a continuation, right? So your leader remains the same. Your traditions that you've unlocked in your civics tree can be, you know, the same if you want, right? And so there are some ageless buildings, but then everything else kind of changes, right? The look of your units, the urban buildings, that sort of stuff. So there's a bit of continuation, but then like things kind of shift a little. And even the ageless buildings, it looks like so. For example, there's some pictures on there, and they look like they're surrounded by. So they do Roman and then Norman city with Roman buildings. And so it looks like that the ageless buildings still have Roman buildings. And then the Norman, then you have a Norman houses like right next door. It might be jarring as you come out of an age to see everything look a little differently, except for a few buildings, but there is some continuity involved at least.
Some cities are like that too, where.
Sure. Yeah.
Some buildings get updated and others don't for just history reasons.
Yeah, no, I was just talking about gameplay. You know, you come out of the age and all of a sudden things look different, and then you got to get your bearings right for a minute or two before you figure out what to do next.
Yeah, that's fair.
And the diary also says that everyone experiences the age transition simultaneously. So there is that concern, right? Is it going to be a rubber band sort of thing? You get to pick legacies to retain. The question is how strong will those legacies be in order to, you know, and that's going to be really what determines how these work and whether or not if the crises seem unfair, that's also going to determine how it works with age transitions or how good or how bad people are fans react to it.
Yeah. And how, like, it's like you say, how much are you punished for doing poorly in an age when transitioning to next, and how put back are you if you're the number one nation as a consequence of an age transition? Like, how much advantage do you retain? This is like, it's clear based on what we've been told that you're going to have an advantage or disadvantage into the after an age transition based on the previous age, but it's not clear to me to what extent.
Yeah.
I feel like the closest analog to the crisis that we have is probably the European invasion in colonization. And I really hope that we don't have a bunch of stuff like that, because that was always annoying, where it feels like you suddenly have to play a completely different game. Most of colonization is like a trade, is all trade and logistics and economics. And then like suddenly you cross a threshold of too many points and it becomes a military war game. So I really hope that these crises don't do stuff like that, where like you're just completely pulled out of like how you were playing the game, like for arbitrary reasons. I don't know if I'm explaining this well, but
I think that's what a crisis is. I mean, unfortunately, I think that's what a crisis. It's pulling you out of how you're playing for an arbitrary reason that you're at the end of the age, right?
Yeah, that's something that worries me, because that was something that always annoyed me in colonization.
Yeah. I think reading the diary helped me a little bit in being more okay with it. That's right. I think that the...
Oh, yeah!
We appear to have been invaded.
Yeah, for arbitrary reasons.
Oh, yeah!
I think what I'm getting at more at is I hope that there's like that it feels like there's a good reason for why these crises are happening, and that it isn't just like, you know, like in colonization where you just trip over a seemingly arbitrary threshold and now suddenly like a good example would be climate change in Civ 6, right? Like there's a reason that climate change happens in Civ 6, and it's a direct result of player actions. Right. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping that the crises in all of the ages in Civ 7 feel more like that and less like, oh, suddenly, you know, the King of England sent 10 galleons or 10, you know, frigates and galleons to invade you for like no real reason. Like you're making crap tons of money for him. You haven't done anything antagonistic other than just making more money. But suddenly he doesn't like that you're generating too much money, so he sends warships.
Yeah. Well, part of the fun balancing that Firaxis has picked up as a result of doing the ages.
I also want to know if we can completely fail in an age. Can we have a game over in an... I mean, obviously, if there's a... I don't know. I think we could.
You know, I think I remember seeing something in the initial reveal about how, like, the number of civilizations or the specific civilizations in the game would also change. So maybe there is some kind of elimination thing going on. Or maybe, like, you know, like imagine, like, in tiered sports leagues, you know, where the top two teams in the bottom tier, like, have, like, a little... Or the top team in a bottom tier has a playoff with the bottom team in the higher tier, and then one moves up and one moves down. Maybe they could have something like that where, like, the bottom, like, two or three civs are eliminated, and then three new civs join the game in the next, leaders. You know, the bottom, like, three leaders are removed, right? And then three new leaders are added. Like, they could have something like that. That could be cool.
Well, I think it'd be funny if you were the one who failed and it just ended, be like, you don't get to go to the next aid. Sorry, you did terribly.
Well, right. If you're in the bottom three, you know, in my example, like, maybe that does happen.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. I mean, I can understand if you have an equivalent of the Mongol invasion, you fail against that, then you fail. But is there other criteria where you could fail, not just military?
No.
That would be interesting.
Because, yeah, there are definitely games where I've played where I would have a fail. You know, if you looked at it from a holistic point of view, you'd be like, yeah, this civilization is failing. They're really good at military, but, man, their science is terrible. You know, like,
we can build the 8-axe wonder a lot, but eventually the eight axes are going to run against knights or something like that.
No,
on the other hand, there was one game in Civ 4 where I unlocked writing in 1080, not PC 80, and won the game because I was able to come back.
And that were was you playing as the Chinese?
No, it was Mali. It was a game I streamed, but it was on like a stream, so I don't even remember anymore.
Oh, darn it! That's a couple. Sorry, it's an alphabet, not writing.
Yeah, there's only a couple people who saw that, but it was probably one of my more amusing games ever. I didn't record it for YouTube because I was streaming it. But I botched a Skirmisher Rush and then, like, had to rely on text-stealing shenanigans to get back in the game. Nearly lost the culture, and then I had to interrupt a spaceship victory while it was in transition, which I barely did via nukes. And, like, I took their capital, like a badly damaged unit that was counter nuked but didn't die. And after doing those two things, after blocking a culture victory and that space victory, I was able to go on to win myself. Nice. So it wasn't easy to do. But on the other hand, like, you aren't just a little bit behind if you unlock writing in 1000 AD. You were like that is late for liberalism if you're playing well. So you can certainly come back.
Well, that's an interesting question though. In Civ 7, like, if you don't in your antiquity age, if you don't research writing, does that mean in exploration no one knows how to read in your civ forever? So I don't think you can go back, right? Isn't the tech tree per age?
Yeah, but presumably the new stuff you can do is contingent on what's available in the new age. So I guess you could just presumptively say that anybody who exists in the new age has the minimum of text from the previous, even if they didn't actually research it, just through like spread of knowledge or like you can certainly hand wave that away.
Hmm.
Might be part of the catch-up mechanic is to level people out with the tech tree.
Yeah, because maybe.
Also, if you super go into the tech tree, you're going to run a point where you're just accumulating science and you have nothing else to research, feasibly. But maybe that's the point of the masteries they introduced, though, now that I think about it.
Well, yeah, and there might also have, you know, each age might have some analog to, you know, future tech. Right, something that you just research repeatedly and it like gives you like bonus happiness or you know yields or something.
Yeah, they could also just points, like maybe. Not reward you for over investing in one resource.
Yeah, or that. I would imagine people would probably get annoyed with that, but you know,
I mean we've had that a design with various things. Like from Civ 1 until Civ 6, like there's always been things you can invest in that either have diminishing returns or aren't worth making at all in the moment. It's science has not been one of those until like literal endgame in previous civs, but there's nothing to say that it has to be that way.
Well, I think a classic example of that would be, you know, building a butt ton of workers early in the game. And then, you know, as soon as you build all your railroads, you have nothing left to do with those workers for the rest of the game.
Yeah. Yeah, that's another good example. And even in Civ 4, like inexperienced players would underbuild workers, but a lot of intermediate players would overbuild them. Because like you could get the same utility from fewer workers, which means you could build other useful things sooner, which made a big difference at the top level, which I never reached, but I got kind of close to it. I got close enough to see the difference, at least, between proper worker counts and over and under building them.
Don't know.
Yeah, I just...
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I just hope that the equalization thing they do doesn't take away things like what Phil did. Because those kind of games are fun to watch if people are playing and stuff like that, and fun to play yourself that you managed to pull off this victory and you shouldn't have. You know, hope we don't lose that in the equalization type of thing.
We'll always have Civ 4.
Well, I mean, like the age transitions might give you opportunities for that too, and that's fine. I just don't want to see it where like somebody who's obviously doing extremely well basically might as well have done nothing in the new age. But it sounds like they're implementing stuff that won't be that way. Like, you'll still have cities, and you might have a golden age coming out. It's like, if you sustain momentum, you'll probably find. It's hard to judge until you actually experience. And experience in its, like, final intended balance form, too. Which we probably won't have even when the game drops officially.
Or, alternatively, it's just, oh, you won the Antiquity Age, and now you're back on a level playing field for a new game.
Yeah, that's fine, too.
That could be what they're going for. Like you
need to win 3 games in a row or win them by enough or whatever, and whoever wins the most is the ultimate winner.
It's like tennis. You need to win the whole set. You won the match, now you have to win the set.
That being said, though, unlike tennis, it seems like they clearly intend for some advantages from the previous set to carry over.
Yeah.
Because your buildings aren't guaranteed to be useful in the next era. You have to earn that. And you're not guaranteed to get a golden age. You have to earn that too. So.
Did we move on to our first looks?
Do it.
Okay, so we had a couple of, I guess these are leader reveals, not civilization reveals. One of the first ones is, of course, in the, you know, first footage that we saw for the game, we saw Hatshepsut. Sorry, I have a toddler on my lap who wants to play podcaster too.
We've heard him. He's very cute.
Yeah, so Hatshepsut gets an agenda called Wonders of Itiru, which says she likes civilizations or leaders that have fewer wonders than herself, and she dislikes leaders who have more. That sounds very familiar. I'm pretty sure we had that exact same agenda on a leader in Civ 6.
I believe that was Qin Shi Huang base version.
Yeah. Yep. Let's see. Then what else does she have? I'm looking at this in video format. I don't have this written. So, and then of course their first look highlights the fact that the game includes navigable rivers and that Hatshepsut will have abilities geared around using those.
Plus 15% production for buildings and wonders in cities adjacent to navigable rivers.
Right. Yep. And then she also gets plus one culture for every imported resource. So if you're also, I don't know how the trade in Civ 7 is going to work compared to like Civ 6, but I wonder if trade happens along those rivers, in which case you also, that's also how you get your resources for bonus culture. Julian, can I have my hand back, please?
Thank you. This was in the dev live stream, which we didn't actually talk about everything in that, but we talked about most of it. The resources are assigned to cities in a screen, so you will have all the resources you pick up will have to be assigned to cities, and some of them are imported and they show up in that screen as well. So we will be the ones deciding which cities get which resources.
Which is cool. That's actually something that I have asked for, you know, going all the way back to Civilization V, is like the ability is to have domestic. I was always talking about strategic resources, but it works for luxury and bonus resources too. But, you know, having domestic uses for your strategic resources. You know, one of the examples I always gave was being able to put like horses or iron in your like arenas, you know, for gladiatorial combat and chariot races and stuff like that, and get like culture or happiness bonuses from it.
Right.
Yeah, or being able to like dedicate, you know, steel or whatever, you know, or dedicating your iron and coal to producing steel that you use to build skyscrapers or whatever later in the game. So, you know, maybe we'll get something like that too, where you actually have domestic and economic uses for your luxury and strategic resources besides just selling them to other factions and using them to build units. So that could be cool. Is there anything else in this first look besides the her abilities that we want to talk about?
I don't think so. Just some graphics.
Yeah, I mean, there's a bit of gameplay footage to go along with it. So
it did note that one of her, I guess it's like we have the flavors on the leaders here. It's like, she's not going to like you if you have more wonders than her.
Yeah.
Yeah, and in this first look video, there are looks at a few of the wonders. Like, we see the pyramids. We see the, oh gosh, what was that? That building that was built into the side of a canyon. The one that was in Indiana Jones.
Petra.
Yes, Petra. Yeah, I think it looks like we see a little bit of that. Something that looks like it might be the Hanging Gardens. I'm not sure. Could just be Egyptian architecture or the palace or something. I'm not sure.
Checking Well of Souls. Oh no, they've made multiple pages now. Shoot.
Yeah. See some buildings that look like they might be mosques. Some nice pretty golden domes. I don't know if those are wonders or buildings.
The Hanging Gardens is confirmed in the game, so we probably saw that. You said golden domes?
Yeah, I saw some building that looks like a mosque with a golden dome and a few, looks like four pillars on all four corners.
Askia's tomb, maybe?
Possibly, yeah. And lots of boats going up and down rivers.
Well, it is Egypt. And then, just released a few days before recording, we have
Augustus. And Augustus is kind of interesting. Well, the one thing that came out in Augustus that everyone grabbed onto was they announced that Spain would be an expansion area era civ that Rome could end up, or I'm sorry, that Augustus could end up being. And then, so, you know, there was a lot of discussion. Oh, are they going to have Castile and then Spain as a modern power? But I guess Spain is going to be an exploration era, which makes a whole lot of sense, I think. It'll be interesting to see what Spain becomes in the modern era. One of the things about Augustus that was interesting is, and this is something we didn't touch about, was in the developer live, was the difference between cities and towns. So, you know, he likes leaders with many cities and dislikes leaders with many towns. And I guess the concept is settlers build towns now, and towns can eventually become cities.
You pay money to make them cities.
Right, that's right. You pay money to make them cities. And so in this case, you know, there actually is a some sort of a gameplay sort of thing involving Rome where they are fine. They like you if you have money to build cities, but dislike you if you have a lot of towns without cities. And, you know, also the thing that continues to be the case with Augustus is people complain about how his leader diplomacy screen looks terrible, and I don't think that's gotten any better since the last time either. He gets 2+ production in the capital for every town, and then he can purchase culture buildings in towns. He's cultural and expansionist. You know, he gets 50% gold towards purchasing buildings in towns. So very much an interesting, you know, kind of a all roads lead to Rome sort of thing, where towns are kind of a little bit favored here for Augustus. It's going to be interesting to see how that, if that shifts at all when it gets to, you know, other eras, because I imagine in the next, you know, ages in expansionist modern, like, you're going to convert most of those, if not all of those towns into cities, right? So does that mean Augustus is not that great later on in the game? I don't know. But it seems interesting that it focuses a lot of his abilities on having towns.
But then also looking down on other players who have lots of towns.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
He's all get on my level.
He's like Augustus in this game is going to be this game's stereotype of the coastal elite looking down his nose at all of your flyover country.
Oh, hey, man.
I'd rather live in flyover country.
I don't know. My initial impression is that you might want a lot of towns, so ability might be good throughout the game.
I mean, I guess it's going to depend on like what towns do and what cities do and what they do that's different than what the other does.
Yeah.
Yeah, we don't have much information on that at all.
Yeah, and maybe this is also
certain things if you have cities and you can't do it with towns.
Yeah, and this is also another thing that you know, is also similar to something that humankind did, where humankind you could build outposts and then those outposts could become cities later, but you could also attach outposts to existing cities. And I think like whatever city the outpost was attached to, like that parent city could like spend money to build districts around the outpost. So I don't know if it's going to work like that or if they've got something totally different up their sleeves.
Yeah. Someone did have a theory on the town focus of Augustus and how he dislikes other people having towns. Maybe that encourages war so that for Augustus, so he takes over other people's towns so that he can have more towns.
Yeah.
He definitely likes towns.
All your town are belong to Augustus.
So, should we end the show?
Oh, wow. Well, okay. In that case, thank you for joining us on podcast episode 441. Especially you, Amran.
Yay. Well, you know, I started playing Civ again because I got an ultra-wide monitor, and I said, how would Civ look on this? And I said, oh my god, it's beautiful. And so, you know.
Yay!
I recommend everyone getting an ultra-wide monitor and playing Civ on it.
Welcome unless back to the fold.
Unless you're a streamer. I've seen quite a bit of people who YouTubers and streamers who have Civ, but I have to watch it on a regular, you know, size monitor, and then it just looks weird. It looks great on your ultra-wide monitor. Does not look so great on other people's standard size monitor watching your stream.
Also, special notice to those of you who are streaming and recording video gameplay. If you are playing in a higher resolution than you're recording in, it's hard to read what you're doing.
Speaking of user interface problems.
This is especially for those of you who play text-heavy games like anything from Paradox or from Civ. It's very hard to read what you're doing if you're already downscaling to 1080 from 2560.
I had a weird problem with, I was trying to do, not streams, but make YouTube Let's Plays for Star Trek Infinite, which is a Paradox published game. And I have my new laptop has like a weird monitor resolution. It's like 25 something by 16 something instead of, you know,
1920.
The standard 1920 by 1080. And what was weird is I was just using the Microsoft Game Capture, like to capture the footage. And not only was it recording at like a different like resolution, but like the cursor position was like offset.
Yeah.
And I could not for the life of me figure out how to fix that. So in my Let's Play things that I ended up posting, the mouse pointer is like not pointing at the thing that I'm actually pointing at in game. Although, you know, because it is a Paradox game, there are like tooltips that pop up for like literally everything that you highlight over. So instead of watching the mouse pointer, like you basically just have to watch the wherever the tooltip pop-up is, and that's actually the thing that I'm pointing at. But it was annoying because I felt like I had to explain that in every single, you know, friggin' video. And it's like I couldn't, like the game wouldn't let me change the resolution. So I couldn't figure out what the heck I could even do to fix that.
You change the resolution in Windows.
I think I tried that too, and it didn't make a difference, but I mean, I guess I could try it again, I don't know. Hopefully if I get around to streaming footage of Civ 7, I don't have that kind of problem.
Anyway, we were in the middle of a closing here.
Yeah. Okay, then, yeah, so to continue our goodbyes, Canis Alvinus.
Oh, poor cat. She's sitting here waiting for me to finish.
Makalua.
We turned into tech support cast again.
And Mega Bears fan.
Hey, how about all them college football games last night? Those were good ones.
I'm Finn, the Megan team. I'll see you next time.
Civilization 3, 4, 5, Beyond Earth, and 6, and 7 sound clips. Copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright The Polycast at thepolycast.net.
Aww.